All right, so once again, wanted to say welcome to everybody. Brothers, tonight's presenter is Brother Eric Juskew. Brother Juskew was initiated into the Iota Omicron chapter of Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia on December 2nd, 2010 at Bowling Green State University. As a collegiate member, Eric served in several roles, including historian, FEO, and president. After graduating in 2015 with a Bachelor of Liberal Studies degree, Eric ultimately found himself working at, that's Town Hall 2?
Correct.
A behavioral health counseling agency, where Eric worked as a billing specialist for 2 years before going back to school. Eric is working toward a master's in college student personnel from BGSU and is set to graduate this spring. During his master's, Eric has worked as a graduate hall director in addition to having volunteer stints with FSL, Fraternity and Sorority Life, as a new member coach and with the esports program as an Overwatch coach. Eric is preparing to do the job. Eric is preparing to do job searching across the country and hopes to find a role that will allow him to help as many students be successful, whatever that ends up looking like. The title of his presentation is Higher Education, Where We Came From, Where We Are, Where We Are Going. Brothers, please help me welcome Brother Eric Juskew.
Hello. I need to share my screen. Screen one. It's going to look weird for a second until I do this. Huzzah. Sorry about that. Okay, cool. As Brother Friday said, I'm Eric. I forgot to mention in my intro, I do use he, him as pronouns. This is showing me on the side already. We're talking about higher education, a little bit about like the history of higher education, some current events, and kind of thinking futuristically about where we're going to go moving forward. As was alluded to, I'm fine with this being interactive. If you have any questions or comments or jokes or fun stories, whatever, share them. Dave will cut me off and insert things where needed. So, I'm going to preface this with the first portion of this is going to be some historical elements of higher education, but I'm cramming like 15 hours of a graduate course curriculum into about 20 minutes or 25 minutes. So it's going to be very generalistic and we're going to think more broad ideas than specifics. So we're going to hop in with where we've been. What are we doing? Does anybody know what the Oxbridge model of education is and kind of what that implies?
I graduated last year and I already forgot.
Totally cool. Isn't
that Oxford, Cambridge?
There is a connection to Cambridge. We combined the words for Oxford and Cambridge, which were British universities that have been around since, 1000, the year 1000. Early universities in America were built upon this model where it was almost separated from the town completely. It was very, here is your college, here is your experience. There is nothing else around. It's in a rural location. And curriculum was very much focused around two things primarily, helping people become lawyers and helping people become clergy. That was kind of the basis of initial US higher education. I've since also put up this date here of October 28th, 1936. Does anybody know the significance of that date? It's cool if we don't, because I'm gonna be honest, I had to look it up because I forgot exactly what the date was. That is actually the date of the first university being founded in the United States. And obviously it wasn't the United States quite yet then, but in America. Does anybody know which institution that was?
Was that Harvard?
It was Harvard, absolutely. Harvard was the very first institution founded, and it was founded on that Oxbridge model. It was founded very much on classics, Latin, law, theology, but not any theology, typically Christianity or Catholicism, really focused in on a specific secular religion. And this gets me to the idea of what higher education's purpose was. What were people studying? Who got to study it? if you think about sort of the founding of it, higher education was founded for wealthy white men. That's the reality. Women weren't going to school. You had to have money to go to school. And I'm talking like considerable money. Middle-class people at that time would not have gone to college. And people of color were not going to be going to college. It wasn't for at least a couple hundred years until you started seeing Black people or Latino, Latina, Latinx people being at an institution. And even when you would see start to see some women going to school, but when women would go to college, their reason to go to college would be to teach their future sons these things. So even when they were allowing women into higher education, it was still done for the purpose of the patriarchy, if you will. My program has a little saying that we almost use as a joke, but like the cohort, like somebody in my class came up with it, of the patriarchy strikes again. This is almost in American history, one of the first big examples of the patriarchy striking is they would only allow women to gain knowledge for the purpose of advancing men. So it's an interesting thing to think about where we came from there. So that was kind of how higher education worked for a couple hundred years. A lot of that's where a lot of the Ivy League schools were founded. Interestingly, all of the Ivy League schools, except for one, were founded under a specific religious denomination. The one was University of Pennsylvania, actually, who I believe was founded by Benjamin Franklin because he wanted to make sure there was a non-secular higher education institution. So just kind of an interesting fun fact from Ivy League colonial times. Fast forward a little bit to 1862, and we've got the Morrill Land Grant Acts. There was also a round of them passed 1892. But does anyone know what these did?
They told states to give up some land so we can find some colleges.
Yeah, that's literally it. It was the birth of the land grant institution. All of a sudden, states, the federal government was giving states land and money to start schools. And this really was where we started to see a transition in both the type of school and who was able to go to school and what was learned at school. You saw more public institutions that were less privatized and more governed by the federal government. A lot of them would become your agriculture and machining schools. So your A&Ms, you saw a lot of your state colleges. One that I know that pops to mind off my head is Ohio State. We just talked about it. Ohio State's a land grant school. I think Kansas State is one. If the school has state after it, very good chance it was a land grant college if it was founded around this time. This act really brought in a new model of higher education, a new way that school was set up in this Germanic model. Does anybody have any experience with what the Germanic model looks like? I'm going to give you an example, and that example would be Johns Hopkins University. It's fresh on my head because I actually was looking at a job posting for a position at Johns Hopkins, so it popped in my head. But Johns Hopkins is a research facility that is also got connections to the medical college there, really focused on research and like getting in and doing some specific job. The Germanic model saw a lot more connection to cities. That's how like Johns Hopkins is in Baltimore. You saw a lot more of a connection to the town, a little more, what can this university do for the community, and less about, we're gonna go off in a corner and be on our own. So now we've got these two almost competing formulas of higher education. Over time, it's kind of started to lean more towards the Germanic model, but there are certainly still schools that lean on the Oxford model more heavily. One of the important things with the Morrill Acts is it was connected with the passing of a, or not the passing, but a civil court case, Supreme Court case of Plessy v. Ferguson. And the whole idea in Plessy v. Ferguson is separate but equal is okay. And that really came about with regards to the Morrill Land Grant Acts, because there were states who didn't want to make a school that was for both white people and colored people. And so in creating those new institutions, they would create a school for white people and a school for black people, or the school for Latino, Latinx people. And it would be separate institutions that people would have to go to. And this is really where you started to see the emergence of HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. A lot of them were founded in that time. So a lot of those schools are land grant institutions. Not all of them, but a lot of them. One that comes to mind is North Carolina A&T, either A&T or A&M. I don't remember which one. But that is an HBCU that was in North Carolina as a result of more land grant acts. 1892 it's basically another round of those acts. So that I just was making sure there was a note that those acts happened in two different years. As I said, there's a lot of stuff I'm skipping over throughout this, and there's some stuff leading up into the civil rights era, like in the 1920s, 1930s, that started to spark some of higher education becoming more inclusive. But the civil rights era was a time of change in higher education. We saw integration happening. We saw Brown v. Board happened, which had an impact on all of the public institutions. We saw a lot of pushes for equal rights. And this is not just with regards to race. This was with regards to gender. This was with regards to nationality, religion. This really, at least in my opinion, marks the start of student activism on campus. Not that there wasn't activism before this, but this is where it really started to gain traction. And you saw things like in 1970, I want to say, students at Kent State's campus were protesting Vietnam War, and there was a shooting that came of that. I've missed one of my points throughout this, but I've got a way that I can kind of connect back in. When we think of that with the Kent State shootings on May 4th, that wasn't the only major school shooting that happened in the 1970s. There was also one at, I believe, Jackson State University, 1979. I could be wrong on the year. That it was at a HBCU. And if you look at both instances of the school shooting, the shooting at Jackson State was by far much more violent and much more, I would say, oppressive. I'm not sure if that's quite the right word for what I'm meaning, but that's the word that came to mind. But everyone thinks, when they think of a school shooting from the 70s, as far as like police shooting in the 70s, they think of Kent State. And why is that? I want to pick y'all's brains. Why do we think of Kent State before Jackson State?
You mean besides race?
No, that's the reason. I don't mean besides race. That is the reason. Because society, quote unquote, has deemed the Kent State shooting more important because it happened to white people. And the Jackson State shooting has almost been removed from history because it happened to black people. And there's a lot of what we learn in our first however odd years of our life that is whitewashed history. And that's kind of the whole point of going through some of this history, is understanding that at the start of education, women weren't able to go to school. People of color were not able to go to school. LGBTQ plus people were not able to be out while they were at school. There was none of that. It was for rich, straight, white men. And that's the kind of the point that I'm kind of getting to with this, that over time, eventually things have started to unravel that. But because for 200-300 years, we were living in a society that was run by the white people, they just put the parts in history that they wanted to. And some of you might understand this, some of you might, this might be new to you, but this is kind of the basis behind critical race theory, which, at least in the state of Ohio, I don't remember if this is everywhere, but is actually being attacked. This might have been a federal one, I don't remember. But we can get to that and when we talk about kind of where we are. So I want to then touch on two things that are kind of in more recent history that I think have a big impact on what higher education has been like today. and that is the era of consumerism and the era of professionalism. So the higher education, when you're studying higher education, we talk about it in eras. So there's a whole bunch of periods of time and they all got an era attached to it. Well, era of consumerism was around 1980s, 1990s or so. And what we saw happen was students started advocating for their own education. They wanted to have certain things. They wanted to have better options, better choices, better facilities. They wanted to like where they were living better. And it was exactly how it sounds. It was consumers were demanding certain things and the universities had to listen because it's a consumer-driven business. If students don't come to college, we have no money. So you started to see a whole lot of this little dynamic where schools would start to almost feel like a country club. You'd have really grand looking buildings. You'd have all the amenities, pools, rock walls at the rec. And that's the thing that everybody comes to is this rock wall. That's on everybody's minds when we talk about this country club effect. And while it does a lot of good to increase the standard of living for students, that comes at a cost. And that costs, I mean, literally, it comes at money. It costs money to do that. And higher education has had some struggles figuring out how to fund that without increasing tuition. I mean, you see the memes on Facebook where, you know, my parents got a college degree for $200 or whatever they would say. That's why, because the college experience that people were paying for prior to the era of consumerism was vastly different than the college experience my generation is paying for. I'm not going to hate on that. I am in favor of it. I see the good it does, but it does come at that cost, and that cost is a financial burden. I wrote a paper on this my first year in grad school on should students have to live on campus? And one of my arguments saying that they shouldn't have to live on campus or that there shouldn't be a live-on requirement was financial, because students would be paying all this money for room and board when odds are the dining services has a monopoly, which means they can charge ridiculous prices, and they're paying for an increased cost of their residence hall. And you see a lot of students taking out loans to cover these things. And I kind of, as a professional going into this field, have take an issue with somebody taking out loans and taking out debt for literal life needs. So there's some arguments that could be made for it's become too expensive, we need to scale that back, but that can be sort of a like, where are we going conversation. The other one here, the era of professionalism, kind of ties in with this whole idea of student affairs as a career path. I don't know who of you all, what you all do, if any of you do work at colleges or universities. Awesome, dope. I love that we have Sinfonians in student affairs. Once upon a time, the people who would work as like a hall director or in certain offices would have those jobs because they were the spouse of a faculty member at the institution, where a faculty member has a teaching gig there and their spouse is now the hall director, because that's just the arrangement they make to get that faculty member at that institution. And so you saw a lot of people who were in those jobs who probably still had a bachelor's degree, but didn't have any sort of professional graduate degree, however you want to word that. Around 2000, like late 2000s, early 2010s, it was kind of realized that there's a lot of theory that goes into play when we're talking about college students. College students have a whole vast array of identities. Every identity has develops in a different way and has different nuances to it. Beyond that, there's different leadership theory and moral development theory and all these different things that are vital to being able to be successful in helping college students get from point A to point B, with point A being, I am now a student, and point A being, I have graduated. I bring this up because I think for me personally, when we look at this era combined with the era of consumerism, it creates an interesting paradox, because the era of consumerism said, we have now a much more expensive university. How do we make sure that students are getting what they pay for? Era of professionalism is kind of how they looked in that. They were like, we'll look at theory. We'll look at hiring people with master's degrees. We'll look at it being a professional area. But with that comes people who, because they now have a master's degree, get paid more. And so it creates this really interesting dynamic where you're trying to give the services that are deserved for the price people are paying, but in doing so are actually increasing the costs on the university. So it's a really weird little push and pull between the two. And we're going to kind of touch on some of that as it pertains to real world today. I just threw a lot of information at you all. Are there any questions or any comments at this point?
I actually had a comment about that. My office mate is the spouse of somebody who now teaches at Boise State University out in Idaho. And when they were trying to onboard him, they had a job offer for my office mate. So this is ringing very true and being interpreted very personally right now. So yeah. Thank you. It's hitting
me. You're welcome. Cool. If there's no other comments or questions at this moment, we're going to shift gears a little bit, talk about where are we right now. I know that Brother Friday works in an institution. I don't know what the rest of you all do, but you all have some engagement or interaction with higher education. If you're a few years removed from it, feel free to add to the conversation, because it's still good information for us. So I put a few things that are like things that are were on my head as far as current events in higher education. I kind of just wanted to open up some dialogue, talk about, you know, what are the impacts of these things on you or on you with regards to higher education, if you do have that knowledge. And then I can give some enlightenment from a student affairs perspective on what all of these things have meant in our roles and in my work with undergraduate students. And we can kind of go from there. So I don't really have a like agenda for this part. We can talk about whatever parts of it we want at whenever we want. So does anybody want to kick us off?
Something I would probably add to this list. I'm not sure that this necessarily counts as what's taking away from higher ed, but I've seen a really big push in recent years to talk about trade schools. That we have a lot of people that are retiring from the fields of heating and cooling or HVAC or whatever it happens to be. And the question of, is the cost truly worth the education versus you can finish trade school in 11 months and start making 75 grand a year working in the skilled trades.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that also brings up the idea of community colleges, because For a long time, community colleges and trade schools were kind of looked down upon. It was like, oh no, you got to go to college. You got to go get a four-year degree. You got to go to college. And I agree. There's a big push now for both community colleges and trade schools where saying, you know, it's okay to do the cheaper option. I know I'm not telling you anything by saying this, Dave, but community colleges are just as good at educating as a standard four-year university. They're just a different thing. On the trade school debate, I am a firm believer in college is not for everybody, and everybody doesn't need to be pushed to go to college. The people who want to and who it is right for, do it. Awesome. if it's better for students to go to trade school, I am going to be the first one in line saying, yes, go to trade school, drop out of our institution, stop spending money here if this isn't what you want to do.
You are literally repeating to me my childhood right now, because the only message that I heard from my mother for the first 17 years of my life is, you are going to college.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me wonder if there's a generational thing there where she's considering what her life would have been if she had been in college in, say, the 1970s.
Interesting.
Whereas, you know, where she actually wound up after the fact. So I get this feeling from this discussion that she may have been saying, you need to go to 1970s college, which makes me think about, you know, exactly all the stuff that you just brought up with where we were.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think I could see there being something generational about it. I think when we think about, you know, college in the 1970s, there had been a lot of push to just increase enrollment, and you saw the GI Bill passed a little bit before then, but in that area, that increased enrollment. And I there was this societal push that if you want to do something with your life, you go to college. I think of a quote actually from, of all movies, Accepted, which, if you're not familiar, is the one where the student makes up the South Harmon Institute of Technology, which, yes, stands for shit. And the main character's father in that movie literally goes on that tirade of, if you want to be something, you go to college. That's what you do. You go to college. Go to college, you get a job. Like, that's, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's that exact same thing. Yeah. Anybody else have anything on kind of that, like, pressure to go to college or pressure to learn certain things or go to certain places?
So I will chime in, brother. First, just for transparency's sake, I actually am the director of a Res Life program at a institution. So
you know my work very closely.
And so I appreciated this because I teach an RA class, and I literally just did like a lot of this content in their RA class this past week. A couple of things. One, in addition to like the civil rights stuff, I think another thing to highlight, because of the elitism and the classism of higher education in the 1960s, was the push for creating financial aid programs make it more accessible for low income and working class folks. But with creating the access with financial aid programs, state and federal funding for higher education started getting slashed. Starting in the late 1970s, early 1980s, by a lot of states. But tuition was doubling, if not more so, causing a huge push to sign up for student loans, especially private loans. And so right now we're seeing a huge amount of students taking on an incredible amount of debt that, you know, you're told that you're going to, you know, only have to pay for this for about 10 years, but, I'm now in year 12 of paying back my student loans, and it's, so we have this huge bubble. I think another thing that is also challenging is with people going into higher education for employment, is the salaries suck. You're working so incredibly much to create this experience. You have a master's degree, depending on where you're at in the country, you're only making, you know, high 20s, low 30s, you know, but you're getting room and board, so yay. so right now we're seeing, I think COVID sort of has caused this now sort of what is considered like the mass exodus out of higher education. And I'm really fascinated to see how the state of higher education, and specifically student affairs, which isn't sustainable by any means, how it's going to change, how our country changes. Now that more and more people are wanting to have a living wage, where they want to be able to work from home. They, you know, they want to have a job that is going to not be a toxic environment, and the list goes on. But kudos to your faculty for teaching you the right stuff. Good job, brother.
Thank you. I will pass along the kudos to Connor. Connor is the professor that I took this class with, and Connor will appreciate hearing that. So no, I couldn't have said a lot of that better myself. You know, it's an underpaid, underappreciated field. Absolutely. And I think I don't want to speak for faculty members because I am not one, but perhaps one of our faculty members at an institution that is in this call could confirm or deny whether that is a similar case for teachers in an institution currently.
So I can verify that there has been an absolute mass exodus away from teaching. Macomb Community College has two main campuses. We have our South Campus and Center Campus. I teach at Center Campus, and between the two campuses, we have 14 full-timers in just the math department. We have one that is now planning his retirement because the transition to virtual learning was his breaking point. He's an old school guy. He is a, give me a textbook, a piece of chalk, and a chalkboard, and I will educate the crap out of you. We recently had our associate dean take an early retirement so that he could be away from this. Our administrative assistant took an early retirement so that she can be away from this. And it seems like on a nearly weekly basis, it feels like that, but you know, 7 hours also feels like 3 days, and vice versa. It feels like we're getting more faculty early retirements happening just all the time. I think, however, there is something to be said about how many people, you know, have been told, you know, you got to go to college, get a degree so that you can get a job. Do we have enough higher ed jobs for everybody who is making their way through higher ed and looking? So rather than working within their desired field, they have to take these jobs that are, you know, big 20s, small 30s a year, but you get room and board.
Yeah. And I can actually maybe give a little bit of answer on that. And I'm sure Brother Hernandez can share as well, knowing that they're in the field as well. But what I've understood is because of the shortage, like I, as a grad student, when my director says there is a shortage of hall directors, I'm like, cool, I will have a job when I graduate, most likely. Will it necessarily pay what it should pay for having a master's? Probably not. Will I have a standard 8-to-5 workday? No. But what I will have is I'll have my passion. And that's what you find in higher ed, is the people who stick in higher ed stick in it because it's their passion. It's kind of like high school teachers in some ways. They stick there because it's their passion, not because they're in the most lucrative field ever. So, I appreciate that. That's some great conversation.
But to be fair, brother, to push back a little bit, that just because we're staying in because of our passion does not negate the fact that we should be paid for our passion.
Oh, I don't discount that at all. Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. that's what keeps people around, but that doesn't mean that it's right, definitely. So I wanted to touch on COVID a little bit. Not that we like necessarily talking about COVID, but I think it's an important piece in this idea of where we are, because that is probably the most prevalent thing facing higher education right now. I know last year at BG, we de-densified campus as best we could. We tried to get down to like one student per room instead of having any roommates. I think we got to about 60% for opening, but like Dave's a numbers guy. If you have a budget that's based on 100% capacity and now you have 60% capacity, that doesn't add up.
I believe you'll probably hit approximately 60% of the desired budget.
Look at that math.
Which makes it, you know, even though there's a mass exodus, you know, that has allowed institutions to continue to understaff departments, continue mm-hmm. to cut budgets. Yep. So not only are we having less students, we have less staff, we have less money to work with, and our staff are stretched incredibly thin. So it sucks all the way around.
Yeah. And on top of that, we are in a little bit of, we're starting to go into a little enrollment cliff anyway. This was pre-COVID that was already projected that there was going to be lower numbers enrolling in school. And at least in my department here, there's a huge emphasis on what experience are people getting for their money and like explicitly making sure that they are getting the best bang for their buck that we can. And sort of like, oh, I don't want to say penny pinching, but kind of thinking it in that sense where like, if we're going to spend this money, we have to make sure it's going towards something productive and useful. And I think it serves as actually an interesting third arc to this era of consumerism, era of professionalism, triad. I don't have a name for the next era because it doesn't exist yet, but it serves as a nice little third stage in this where now, because of a mass exodus of employees, decreased enrollment, and a big like financial hit that most institutions have taken from COVID-19, it is more important now than ever to make sure that the money that departments are spending, and this isn't just res life, this is every department on campus, the money that they're spending is more important now than ever, that it is being used effectively and that we're kind of making sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do, which kind of keeping true to the theme adds just more work onto the plates of somebody like a hall director. Because now, where before I might have been able to be a little bit less specific about budget requests, I got to have it down to the penny. I got to say what they're doing, how many people went, because administration want to know more about what money is being spent for.
So if I could interject something, yeah. Along the lines of people being spread thin and whatnot, we do have fewer sections of math classes being offered at MCC, but out of our 8 full-time faculty members that we have at Center Campus, only 3 of them are going to be teaching remote classes next semester. So MCC, the math department, we made the decision quite some time ago that for the 21-22 academic year, we're just going to stay full remote. Math is a lecture or discussion-based class as opposed to a practical lab or a science lab class. Our need to return to campus is considerably lower than like a vet tech program or an EMT yeah. program or respiratory therapy, but it's still very frustrating to see that the sections that we do have are being covered by so few faculty. Many of our faculty who are online trained have opted to just pick up only virtual classes, which are the 8-week. You break it up in terms of goals for the week, and students just work at their own pace. These are situations where students aren't necessarily interacting with their instructors at all. They're just learning the material that has been presented to them. And I'll be honest with you, remote teaching is very, very difficult, especially in the field of mathematics, where there's a lot of symbols that you can't necessarily find in your average Microsoft Word document. But it's, at first it was a fun challenge, and now it's just a challenge.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on that, speaking from a student affairs perspective, when we went to the virtual platform, you know, students are now disconnected. They're not getting the social outlets. They're not getting the same support and services and resources. Yes. You know, even though we tried to provide them virtually, it's not the same experience. And we also saw an uptick in mental health challenges, you know, as a result. We now have 3 classes of students that have been affected in some capacity by COVID. And their mental health has been bananas. as a result of that. I think one interesting thing to add to this is the reduction of campus shootings as a result of COVID and other, you know, I mean, that's because nobody's on campus, you know, for the last year. But even with the amount of time that we've been on campuses this year, there has been a reduction of campus violence. And I find that to be incredibly fascinating, to say the least. Has for those of you who work in higher education, other than campus shootings, have you noticed any other sort of practices or incidents that were sort of the norm before COVID that are now no longer the norm, or it's just completely different?
I would dare say crime across the board is down. We get a monthly report from the MCC police. Oh, sorry. Now that Brother Zaft is here, I should say the whole thing because he is currently at an MCC himself.
Yeah, you're at the other MCC.
Yes. At Macomb Community College, we get a monthly and an annual report about any crimes that take place on campus, whether it's, you know, somebody picked up my backpack, somebody stole my laptop, stole a cell phone, theft, assault, any of that, illicit substances on campus. It's all down across the board.
I think it's hard for me to say specifically because I never worked in the field of higher education outside of COVID, because I started as a grad hall director last year. Yes, I went to my undergrad pre-COVID, but I didn't necessarily have the inside scoop on everything that was happening on campus. I think there's actually been some other things that have happened at BGSU that actually make me almost say that there's more like crisis level things like that happen, but maybe less just the general type of crime, if that makes sense. Because I'm sure many of you have heard about this, but we had the student that passed away last year from hazing. We had an individual come onto campus with a gun, which was a thing that freaked out a lot of my students, but no shooting, thankfully. But I feel like we just had a couple of just really weird big ticket things that have happened. But I can definitely, like, I think a lot of the pettier stuff, the thievery, the breaking and entering, a lot of those things have died down.
Eric, I don't know if you have eyes on the chat, but Brother Courtright informed us that March 2020 was the first month without a school shooting since 2002.
Dang. Which sadly makes a whole lot of sense, because that's the month that like every higher education institution sent people home. So there's something to be said for that. You know, stats tell us, can be manipulated, but stats do tell us things. And so that stat does tell us, you know, less nobody on a college campus, no shootings. So there is a correlation there, but not sure how useful it might be other than recognizing the impact that COVID has as far as like potentially a positive impact.
Tying this to our fraternity, thinking of sort of where higher education is going, how do we see collegiate member recruitment being impacted, not only in response to the things that you have listed on here, but if we're, you know, I anticipate we will have at least one more year of sort of in some form of COVID kind of environment. Yeah. But how do we see the impact on collegiate membership recruitment and chapter survival?
It's hard. I worked, so three of my desk clerks last year were actually members of the chapter here at BGSU. And one of them was a president, one of them was a vice president, one of them is now this year's president. So I got really close to those folks from a just working lens. It wasn't even like necessarily the like, hey, bro, lens. It was the, like, that's my boss type of lens. But we would talk about Phi Mu Alpha regularly. And, you know, they didn't take a class in the fall because of COVID. They didn't want to do a remote process. There was a remote process that would have been available to them, but they didn't want to do that. And I supported them in that decision. I was like, nope, yep, I hear you. I wouldn't want to either. And they were going to do a process in the spring. Everything was all, hooray, we can do this. And then at least at BG, we had that crisis happen with the student who passed away. And FSL shut it down. They're like, nobody's doing any more new member stuff for the semester, which is fair on FSL's part. Like, I understood that. But you've got a great point, you know? The chapter went from 40-some people, I want to say in 2019, 2018-ish, and they're at like 13 right now, I think. So it's spooky. It's a little scary. I don't know that I have an answer. I just have an eloquent way of confirming the problem.
Brother Friday, how are things going in your province with the collegiate chapters and recruitment? Were they able to, any of them able to recruit this year? And if so, what have those numbers been like?
I am so glad that you asked. Well, one of my chapters, one of the chapters in Province 2 is actually Iota Omicron that Eric just spoke on.
Yep.
We have what I would consider to be two high-risk chapters. The Beta Iota chapter is down around five collegiate brothers. That's my initiating chapter, Brother Courtright's initiating chapter. And Epsilon Alpha at the University of Toledo is down at, we'll say, 3.5 collegiate brothers. There's one that is really on a professional semester this year, but is still attempting to help out as much as possible. For the Epsilon Alpha chapter, their chapter president / FEO / I don't know, like six other officer positions, because they only have three brothers, is now the drum major for the Rocket Marching Band. Gosh. And as such has been able to recruit very heavily from the marching band. Oh. I believe that he had confirmed that they had approximately seven people interested in becoming members. So I am less concerned about their chapter now. The Beta Iota chapter is starting to find support in lots of great ways. I actually had the pleasure of attending their homecoming. Time isn't real. Last weekend, two weekends ago, I'm unsure because it's very difficult to keep track of time nowadays. I think it was two weekends ago. Their new esports director is a brother from the New Pi chapter, Carlo de Los Angeles. They're finding some support from the faculty members. Specifically, there's a professor in the chemistry department who definitely needs to be initiated as a faculty member, who's been advocating specifically for the blues and jazz within the Albion community. And I know that he was responsible for getting some of the live performances. As a result, Phi Mu Alpha is starting to have a better presence on their campus. And I think between Coach de Los Angeles and the collegiate brothers, I think that they'll probably be able to get a decently sized class this year. The institution, however, Albion College, has been a lot more lax in making sure that guests that come to campus are allowed into buildings, for example. So when I was on campus, I felt very safe, very secure. They were requiring masks in all of the buildings. Enforcing it was hit or miss, but overall I feel as though those two chapters are going to bounce back just fine, and those were the only two that I was particularly concerned about.
Brother, and this is just purely rhetorical, you do not have to respond, but is that in response to or in spite of the support received from Lyrecrest or our national president / province governor?
I am saying this while being recorded with the intent that it is going to be broadcast to everybody. What support? The message that we got from President Lichtenberg on or near Founders Day is the first thing that any of the collegiate brothers that I talked to on a regular basis had heard from him in months, if not over a year. We are going to be discussing this weekend as we put together an unofficial province workshop due to the fact that only our governor can call one, and currently Mark Lichtenberg has not called for one. We are going to have some frank discussions, and we're going to see if we can get some brothers as riled up as I feel they need to be. Right now, we are actively being told that Province 2 cannot have delegates at our upcoming national convention by denying us a province governor, by denying us our ability to have a province workshop, and therefore our inability to elect a CPR as a result. I feel myself getting worked up, so I'm going to call on Brother Courtright.
Well, I'm always good for lowering the temperature in the room.
Oh, yeah, you are.
Based on this conversation going on here, I actually just popped over to the chapter Discord to see what the collegiates were talking about. And a couple of days ago, they were preparing for chapter day, trying to figure out what the list of current, the complete list of presidents was. And I couldn't help myself but throw in a quick snark that at one point, Lyrecrest was able to provide that.
Yeah. And those are all very real current events, at least to us. You know, that might not be as much of a like higher education thing, but boy, does that matter to the folks in this room. You know, I think to myself, and I think when I talked with Dave about this the other day, I can't believe that it was 2 years ago. What, like, I am wondering, when is there going to be a solution? But that's just me personally. So,
I mean, based on updates to the court case, it looks like there will not be a resolution until after our national convention allegedly takes place.
Yeah.
Worth noting that the national convention actually can't take place as scheduled because none of the constitutional obligations for the fall have been met.
Once again, leading me to the question of what support?
But anyway,
Sorry, are we going to get back to higher ed, or
yes,
do we want to just move on to this one?
I think we can roll back to higher ed if for no other reason than to really take some of these talks about what's going to happen, where are we going, and really start to come up with some solutions. And this maybe we need to have these conversations with regards to Phi Mu Alpha. Cool, that's fine. Whatever you all want to do with it is fine by me. But where are we going? What's happening next? You know, what will the next era be called if we talk about higher ed? What will the story be of higher education through the 2020s? Or what will the story of Phi Mu Alpha be throughout the 2020s? What are the hardships we'll face? You know, just kind of some open dialogue. I know we've kind of been doing that already. But you know, let's take some of what we've learned and be a little strategic with it and try and do some brainstorming.
Well, I wanted to build on something that Brother John Hernandez had said. Are you all considering the next generation? Because as we were talking about schools reopening in here in Delaware, you know, I was having conversations with my coworkers who are parents, and they were desperate we're talking grade school, we're not talking higher ed. They were desperate for the kids to go back to school. They said it's been a nightmare. Their kids have barely learned. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these articles, you know, John brought up, you know, about mental health of current students. But I don't think y'all are prepared for the wave of, you know, grade school kids that are getting ready to either come to college or will be coming to college in the next decade that have gone through this, are still going through this.
We were having some talks within my office here at one point, preparing for this year, in that our first year student class was going to be coming in after basically a month and a half of not having social interaction. Obviously some, but like not to the same capacity as like I did my senior year of high school. And And that's been a tricky thing to navigate. I echo everything Brother Hernandez said about the mental health concerns that have happened. We've had so many roommate conflicts because people have not learned some of that conflict management stuff that they would learn in the end of their high school experience. We have a lot of, there's a lot of issues that it feels like we're addressing that perhaps normally would have been addressed at a high school level. And you bring up a great point. What happens when it's the students who are in fourth grade, third grade right now? What happens when they come to us? Will it be similar? Will it be different? And we don't know. I think that's a good question to ponder.
Then of course, you know, my other concern from a professional standpoint kind of goes back to, you know, the push to get everybody to have a degree. So in state government, almost all the jobs require a degree, particularly the higher end, your IT, your science, your engineering, they all require at least a bachelor's degree.
Right.
I've sat in on interviews at least four times now. The quality of education that these kids are getting is tanked. You know, even people with one master's is not the same as another master's degree. I mean, yes, this may come off a bit high and mighty, but I did a thesis track. And, you know, I interview people who have master's degree, but did non-thesis tracks. And this is for sciences, though.
Yeah. I follow. You're totally fine.
They don't know how to write. They don't know how to think scientifically. You know, they don't know how to think outside the box. They're not curious. There's no intellectual, you know.
Right.
None of that drive there. It was all standardized.
Yeah, all they did for their master's was take some classes and take some tests.
Yep.
There's no contribution to science or to, yeah, agree.
So I didn't take any tests, Gordon.
Huh?
I didn't take any tests.
You could get a master's without a comp?
Welcome to education.
No way.
Wow.
What? Education, wow. Master's.
No way, dude.
College of education at a master's level is wild, let me tell you, as a person in that college. I do a crap ton of writing, but I've taken one test in my career.
One
test? I did a thesis and a comprehensive.
I just had to do a thesis.
Lucky. Also, higher education is very, very odd as a discipline. But I wanted to dig in on something that Brother Hoffman mentioned, specifically two words that you mentioned, why and drive. Why are students in college? I think, you know, sometimes they won't know that. But what can, for those of us who are either going to be working with high school age students who are preparing to go to college, those of us who are working with students while they're in college, or maybe just raising children and sending them off to college, how can we help them understand why they want to go to college? What is it that they have a drive in? Maybe that's the question to answer, is how do we connect students to why?
Well, and I think that's where the community colleges and where vocational schools and all of that come into play.
I love that answer.
So, you know, not everybody has to go to college.
Yeah.
But it's going to work. But now we're at a crossroads where, like I said, all the government jobs require that degree. So, you know,
even talking like technical government jobs, like a construction worker. Are you talking that as well, or you're talking like working in like a government building?
I think like if you're working for the Department of Transportation, most of the jobs do require a degree. Dang. Unless they're a specific labor job.
Okay,
and then they don't necessarily pay as well.
Which,
of course,
is, yeah.
Even the ones that do require the degree. So I said to John privately, I wish I got paid well for my master's degree. I get paid the same as people with bachelor's degrees.
Yeah, me too.
So. We have a brother Tenorio with his hand raised.
Hey, guys.
Mario!
Hey, how you doing, Gordon? Hey, Dave. Hey, guys.
You might win the best mic award for this session.
I've been saving up to upgrade my stuff to do more YouTube stuff.
Yeah.
All that good stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, but, you know, this whole situation is screwed up. I'll tell you that. It's I mean, this is one thing. Yeah, like you're going back and saying, like, yes, we got to remember, like, why are students going to college? There's got to be something that drives them to be, hey, I want to be this, I want to be that, and drive to get that degree. And of course, like you said, school's not for everybody. That's just, you know, not everyone's going to love it, going to a university or even a community college, what have you. So if getting a degree is not what they, I guess, want because of what they've experienced, they should have other options like vocational schools, technical schools, a trade school. And what really upsets me with some people, and I'm sure some of you have heard this, where there's one side of the room that shits on trade schools and all that, and the other side that shits on universities. It's like, dude, wait a minute. Like I said, school's not going to be for everyone, but not everyone's going to get like a degree, a bachelor's, master's, or whatever. But trades are still vital to our economy, are still vital to our society. And like you were saying about certain government jobs requiring degrees, not so much degrees, but at least certification of what you do, like mechanic. You got to be certified to be a mechanic in, you know, automotive, trucks, aviation, things like that. I mean, that's very important. So, but there's just these two arguments, like, dude, both are important, but you just got to find out what works for you. I mean, I'm blessed, you know, I got my 2 degrees now, thank the Lord, but was it easy? No, but for someone that's looking to do, you know, that's looking to get something that they want to be good at, the route that I chose may not be the right route for them. So for those of you that are educators, isn't that the whole point of trying to help students? What is it that they want to do? And that's the whole point of them trying to help them figure out what path they have to take. That's why it's like the path that we have to take.
Oh.
And it goes back to when I was initiated with
Yeah, I like that connection.
It reminds me every time when I think about it, it's like, well, my path, what I planned in my head did not go exactly how I wanted, but I ended up getting what I was, my goal. I guess is also this point is we have to help students like not only find their path, but at least set goals to help them achieve. Okay, get this goal, another path opens up, get to this goal, 2 more paths open up, things like this are like the analogy about opening up more doors. But people got to stop just talking down on, oh, you know, this is bad, this is good for you. It's like, no, in the end, it's your choice what is good for you and what is not good for you. Only your educators, the ones that are educators, are the only ones I can only help guide you to what is going to lead you to what you want. So
yeah.
Anyway,
I like a lot of what you said there, and it got me thinking about something that one of my professors actually tells us in our program, which is not that we are student affairs professionals or insert thing here. It's that our job title, what we do, is as student success intervention specialists. That's what he calls it. He mentions that.
Sounds fancy.
Yeah, it sounds fancy. It really is probably overly fancy, but
success intervention specialist, SIS. Cool.
But that's the point to that is we are in such a position, like myself in Res Life, I'm in such a position that whether I'm talking with one of my resident advisors, one of my desk clerks, a student that I'm meeting with for conduct, or a student with that's having a mental health concern, I am in a position that I can have those conversations about what are you here to study? What do you want to do? And I can't tell you the amount of times when I'm sitting in a conversation with somebody, especially first year students, and I'm asking them, you know, what are you trying to do? And they have no idea what they want to do, which is like, fine. I understand it takes time, but who is going to be the one to help them? And it kind of even ties in with the bystander effect a little bit. I can't assume that this person's going to get that help from their academic advisor or from a faculty member. I can't assume that. But what I can do is have that conversation with the student here and now, try and identify that. I was meeting with a student just the other day who, as we're talking, this is going to be a long story, so I'll just throw it to Brother Hoffman.
I was just going to sort of clarify that, you know, whoops, I thought I cleared it.
I think you did.
Sorry, I put your hand down. You cleared it.
Okay. Yeah. So one of my concerns about the future of higher education is sort of the intangibles that you get with higher education. You know, as much as I am pro community college, pro trade school, you don't get that, you know, going away. And this sort of ties back into what you did your report on with, you know, the expenses of being required to live on campus.
Yep.
There are huge benefits to living on campus.
Absolutely.
Intangible benefits. And it's clear, I mean, yeah, I'm going to make it political. It's clear looking at politics that there is something to higher education, you know, on both sides, actually. Yeah. It's some of those intangibles, the, you know, the liberal arts credits that you have to take, the breadth of study credits that we all have to sit through, depending on your university, you know, the being forced to live with strangers in close quarters, you know.
People might be from a different party than you. Oh my God.
Right. But that's the thing too, is that, you know, there are Republicans on these campuses. Yeah. There are conservative people. Part of going to school is learning to, you know, how to interpret, how to get along. You know, those are some of the intangible things, which is actually much more what your all jobs is about, is ensuring that everybody does get along when they're in these highly stressful situations. And that is one of my concerns with the extreme costs of college. And I would hope that even the trade schools and even the community colleges would give, you know, a little bit of a liberal education, which some of them do. But, you know,
you bring up a really interesting point here with this liberal education. And
yeah,
and for just to clarify, because I was confused about it prior to a month ago when my teacher really fully explained it. Liberal education is not liberal versus conservative education. It's liberal meant like referring to the Latin word of for free. So it's this idea of taking what the student wants in a lot of ways and kind of looking at it that way. So just for the clarification, and I don't remember the term for it, but it's kind of the opposite of the liberal education. I am blanking and Ken Borland would hate me for forgetting that term right now. But there's this debate between
vocational, is that the word you're looking for?
It fits at least. It at least serves the purpose of what I needed. So looking at liberal versus vocational education. And, you know, if college is much more expensive, but a student knows exactly what they want to do, why should we make them take all of these things? The converse, the inverse to that being, in order to be good members of our society, they need to take these things because these are ways that they can understand all of society. Yeah. It's a really big debate going on right now in higher education.
Here's my perspective as an old guy. I graduated from the University of Arizona in 1985, okay? 35 years ago, 36 years ago. It was a long time ago. The things that I work on now didn't exist in 1985, right? They just did not, right?
Yeah.
The internet existed, but you couldn't get access to it unless you were at a big company or at a university like the University of Arizona. So the things that I work on every day are things that I've had to learn, right? And I could learn them because what the university really taught me was not digital signal processing or Python, since Python didn't exist. What it taught me was how to learn.
Yes.
It taught me how to learn and how to think critically. And those are skills that everyone needs to have in our society today in order to be a good citizen, regardless of whether you are a plumber or a daycare worker or a teacher or a cashier or whatever, or a stay-at-home mom or dad. You need to be able to think critically and to reason and to learn, be able to learn. So our high schools aren't doing a great job of that, some of them better than others. But we tend to rely on college for that, and that's probably a problem.
I wasn't going to mention that the grade school is a big part of that. You know, yeah. If we weren't so focused on testing, as you just said, and critical thinking in grade school, it would be college could do more.
Yeah. And I'm going to just throw some in here and then I'll throw it to Brother Tenorio because you hit on this idea of students maybe aren't ready for college even. They're not at the same standard that they need to be to do college level learning. And so even if we have the best first year student program ever, if the student's not at the level that we need them to be successful there, they're not going to gain what we're looking for them to gain. So it's a really good argument there. Brother Tenorio?
No, yeah, Gordon touched on some major points that I was taught as a little kid, you know, that always said you got to use your critical thinking skills. Both my parents were hard on me on that. And look, am I the smartest guy? No. Do I sometimes don't think critically enough for certain things? Of course not. But when it comes to things that I guess I care about, I'm passionate about, I'm going to put all my energy into figuring it out. So you're right. And this breaks my heart, but you know, education in the United States of America is on the decline, and it's on the decline fast. And the Department of Education is not helping. You know, they only care about funding for certain programs, and that's what certain schools care. They only care about funding for certain things, and like, oh, we need money for this sector, so we pump it up over here. But what about everybody else? That's what I kind of get with the stupid testing. Like, you know, being from Texas, living through that No Child Left Behind legislation BS, I was like, I loathed taking those stupid tests because I didn't learn anything. I mean, yeah, you studied and studied and studied and studied and studied to take the test, but did you learn the material in your class, like, to retain for the future? No, not really. And that's the frustrating part about now. It's just, you're right. A lot of students are not being prepared for college. Like when I was like junior, senior year in high school, you know, they push, you know, you gotta, you know, learn how to take SATs, ACTs to try to, you know, get into the favorable college you want in order to help you. And at least some of the counselors I had in high school, like, helped me, like, what do you want to do to lead you down the right direction? And most of my class, when I graduated high school, knew what they wanted to do, with a handful that still were like up in the air. And then when I got to college, of course, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to go into music. I wanted to go into performance. That's why my heart was set on it. That's what I'm going to do, come hell or high water. Now, of course, there's some that, like you said, they get to college and they have no clue what they want to do, what do they want to study, what they want to train for, what they want to get a degree in. So a lot of them spent, you know, years just throwing their money away because they still don't know what they want to do. And that's where you get the term professional student, because they're just in school most of their life and they got all these credits and they end up with just a multidisciplinary degree, which doesn't really mean anything. It's like, oh, you got all these credits in all these areas, but not a particular skill that you want to do. Like, I guess, does the saying the jack of all trades, master of none apply there? I don't know, but it's an issue that I fear if we don't do something that, you know, they're just going to fall further and further behind. But I just feel it's by design, because a lot of people, they don't want critical thinkers. They don't want people to figure things out, problem solve, and ask questions when something doesn't feel right. They just want people to say, yes, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. They just want people just to follow orders. And like, that's not how it's supposed to work. But that's what I feel a lot of people in high places, especially in government, they want. That's what they want. Another brick in the wall, as Pink Floyd would say.
So I would say that critical thinkers disrupt systems. They disrupt status quo. They challenge, and people don't want that. You know, this gets back to like social justice. You know, and that's the thing about you know we want to. Yeah, I'll stay off my soapbox. But yes.
No, but you're right.
You have my permission to go on your soapbox if you want. because that's kind of, that's, we're here to talk about it. And I think sometimes it's those soapbox speeches. It's those moments, like, while it's played up, it's the moments like in Hamilton where Alexander Hamilton gets up on the soapbox literally and is like, no, this is silly. We should revolt. Like, it's that that inspires change. So go for it.
And that's the sad part. A lot of people, they view change. I don't know what it is, but the general public, I'm not saying you all, but generally people view change as a negative, bad. Like, wait a minute. You got to assess what change is coming to see, you know, will this benefit everybody or just a few, or will it benefit good working people or, you know, billionaires that don't give a damn about you? That you gotta do that by a case by case basis. You can't just say, oh, all change is bad, but people just react negatively to any change. It's like, well, assess what the change is, use your critical thinking and make your own decision after that, whether you still agree with, you still disagree with the change or not.
Change requires adaptation. Adaptation requires all of those skills that we've been talking about up until this point. The ability to problem solve, the ability to think critically. That's why so many people are averse to change, is because they don't know what the future will then hold for them.
Right. Of course. I mean, not all change is good. I'm not saying that at all.
Most people fear change, even though it's inevitable.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that are changing.
I was reading an article, I think it was on NPR or something, and it said that a majority of Americans believe that America has turned in the wrong direction since the 1950s.
Is that a majority of white people?
Thank you.
So it's a majority of, I think, of Americans, whatever that means, a majority of the people who took this poll. But yeah, a majority said that, you know, life in America has gotten worse since the 1950s.
I mean, yes and no. There's some things that have gotten better, yes, but there's some things that have gotten worse. So it's very subjective. Like, define good then and now, and define bad then and now. It's you know, we're looking at it. We're not looking at it through the eyes of then. We're looking at it through the eyes of now. We got to, you know, it's that way in order to be objective. That's what I was taught. It's like, look at things that were wrong back then. It's like, well, that's how it was. You're looking at it through your, I guess, our lenses as of now. And instead of looking back, you know, you got to put the lens on and see how it was thought of, how it was seen then. And that's tough.
Yeah. And this might get a little soapboxy. So apologies in advance, but Brother Zaft brought up the statement of, is it best for most white people? And there's something to that. And when we think about this idea of marginalization, oppression, the civil rights era, which was the 1960s, it was born of trying to take power away from the privileged. In the case of, in that moment, it was rich, straight white men. We were trying to take power away from them and transfer that power to people of color, LGBTQ plus people, people who aren't Christian, women, insert marginalized identity there. And the reason why so many people feel it would have been better in the 1950s is because those people are the people who have lost power, because they are privileged. And now the people who they have marginalized are saying, no, we want a piece of that.
Just to challenge you a little bit, brother, those people are still in positions of power. They're still.
Right. I understand. I speak very absolute, and sometimes it bites me in the butt a little bit. But when I say taking power, I mean things like having the right to vote. I mean things like having the right to equal education, having the right to go to the same school as somebody who is white. All of those things came about in the 1960s. That's why there's people who feel like it'd be better in the 50s, because they've lost societal power. Maybe I don't mean literally having the position they're in, because there's clearly still a disparity in demographics in governance. But it's about those little chunks of power that have been taken away from the white people over time, that they're trying to be like, no, I liked it better before. Of course you did.
Because they make it all about them.
Yes.
It's not all about you. Don't worry about what other people are doing. Focus on what you got to do and go about your business. Don't try to steal the limelight when no one cares what you're doing, bro.
I wonder if these people that are claiming that life was better in the 1950s were alive for it.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Sure, very few are. Not many.
I was going to say, if we are talking about those kinds of people, then we are talking about people that are in their 70s, 80s, 90s at this point, who probably, I won't say probably, the stereotype that pops into my head is my stepfather, who doesn't know how to use the internet or send a text message.
There you go.
Gruff.
I also wonder how many of them.
You know, your formative years in the 50s, you know, you went through the World Wars, so.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it does make me think that, yeah, most of the people responding were not alive during that time.
Yeah. Brother Hernandez, you were saying?
Yeah, but I also wonder how many of those are vaccinated, you know, or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That don't have polio.
Now we're opening up a whole other can of worms too that we could go down, which I'm all for. But I,
you listed COVID as troubles that we're having now.
You're right.
Can I share something positive about COVID?
Yes.
I realize that using positive and COVID in the same sentence sounds terrible, but
I was going to say.
Yeah. Thank you. My BFF, Chris Reed, and his wife, Trisha, they have two wonderful kids that are now ages 9 and 7. They have appointments tomorrow to go get their first dose of the vaccine. And they are going to FaceTime with Uncle Dave at some point tomorrow so that, aww, I can tell them how happy I am for them and how proud I am that they're making a responsible decision to go get the vaccine.
Yay. Well, are there any, I mean, I'm sure we could talk for years, but anything else that anybody wants to chat on or anything that anybody wants to build on? Or
so undoubtedly we're going to keep the conversation going beyond just the presentation material. So if there were other comments on specifically where are we going with the field of education, we could probably finish up that discussion.
I mean, ultimately I think if they can figure out how to make college free or extremely cheap for people and still pay, of course, you know, the professors and you people, that's the solution, because it should be attainable for everybody regardless if they want it. And I mean, the reality too, and I think you did touch on it, but you know, the cost is an obstacle for many people of color as well, by design, of course.
Yep.
So you know, that's another issue. And you know, there is that is also an issue with the trade schools and community colleges, is now you're pushing people of color to the cheaper options, you know, because they need to make money.
Yeah.
And that's not even going into the stigmas of being, you know, Black and college educated.
You just hit on so much of the logic behind systemic discrimination. You said it better than I could have in that moment.
Brother Hoffman, are you promoting socialism by saying that, you know, college should be free?
Yes.
There are at least three state constitutions that say that college should be as nearly free as possible.
Exactly.
Man, really, education in general should be free.
Exactly.
Yes. Everybody is entitled to a good free education.
Thank you.
And by good, I mean broad and, you know,
where you have options.
If the first 12 years of your education can be free and paid for by taxes, what's wrong with four more?
Thank you. And beyond that, well,
clearly, Dave, you've bought into the government.
At least your undergrad. I mean, you're right. Well, you bring up a good point, Dave. It's like, you know, in some states, they pay through, like here in Texas, we pay through property taxes to fund our schools and all that. And Of course, with my parents, were like, well, you guys are grown up. You don't have to worry about that. Why should I still have to pay for that since my kids are no longer in school?
Because we don't want to be surrounded by stupid people.
I get that. But I mean, at the same time, I understand it's like, you know, we all want to make sure everyone gets a fair share. That's our civil, as citizens of the United States of America. That's our, I feel that's the least we can do. Now with higher education, I feel the same, it should apply the same way, because it, we all want to do good at what we do and be able not have to worry about money when it comes to doing that. So I feel the system should be set up the same way as elementary, middle, and high school. And I don't know why that's a hard concept to grasp when a lot of other countries, they do the same thing. And yeah, okay, so our taxes may be a little higher, but if it's going to help pay from my kids and someone else's kids, where we all do it together, then I'm all for it. Now if a kid decides to do that and they just waste their time, you know, not, you know, screwing around and not getting the job done, then I'll be like, you know, I'm paying through my taxes to have you go to school and you're not doing that. Then I don't know, as far as penalties, as far as that kind of behavior is concerned, that we would have to figure that out. But however, so I want to see that happen, but that's not going to happen anytime soon, because too many universities have that for-profit motive and they are going to fight to the bitter end to hold on to that. That's the sad part.
So I think there's one, I have a theory to your question. The other one, you saying they have this for-profit motive, actually reminded me of an interesting quote that one of my professors mentioned, which was that Ivy League institutions are actually more like banks than like colleges, which is they're just in the business of managing money. Do with that information what you will. But my theory, specifically with regards to why can't it just be free, why other countries can do that. For me, I part of my undergrad degree wound up being some political science stuff. And I'm very passionate when it comes to like taxation and specifically taxation theory. And I have at least my ideas on what logically should work. And there's a trio of issues at play that I see. Issue one, lobbyists. issue two, people with a lot of money. And then issue three, companies being considered people. Like there was a legal precedent that a corporation can be considered a person. So now that legal corporation or that corporation can give a lot of money to a politician through their lobbyist to basically earn their vote. And it becomes less about what does the public want and more about what does this billionaire want? What does Boeing want for their next thing? Obviously, Boeing wants a higher defense budget because that means that the army will buy more planes. Boeing's not going to want lowered defense budgets. And so Boeing will pull support financially for any politician that opposes that, as opposed to saying, no, we should move some of our defense budget over to education. That's, at least in my opinion, where the issue comes from.
Greed.
Most definitely.
My particular theory in regards to making higher education free, that if you make it more accessible to the poor, to people of color, to women, to the marginalized, that again continues to disrupt the status quo of classism, racism, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy. And with, you know, at least half, if not more, of our states controlled by a political party that wants to take us back to the 1950s, I don't see them wanting to fund because they want to continue to oppress. But also, this particular political party believes that higher education promotes liberalism and socialism and, you know, again, disrupts those status quo. So
those words are so scary.
So as long as higher education is seen as a liberal breeding ground for, you know, folks, a political party is not going to support offsetting the cost, if not outright making higher education free.
One thing that occurred to me, because it didn't come up tonight, and I just, and as I was thinking about it, I haven't heard about it in a long time, but I guess, is the European model off the table? That where, you know, when you graduate high school, you do, you know, 2 to 4 years of either civil service or the military, and then you get free education, which kind of also helps with the whole, you know, people not knowing what they want when they go to college, or even going to trade school or community college. Is that even still something people talk about?
I mean, well, like here in the United States, they, for those that go to the military that choose to serve, they get the GI Bill and pretty much their school is completely covered. I mean,
or there's ROTC students who similarly get it covered.
Right. I mean, but I guess the difference is here, I mean, over there, you're saying it's required. Here, it's voluntary if you choose to. But the thing is, I just don't agree with, you know, making it mandatory or require for you to have to serve the military when it's like, well, if that's not what you want to do, you already know what you want to do. You shouldn't have to be forced to do that. That's my thing. But of course, you know, that's how they do it. That's none of my business. But
most of them have the civil service option. It's not strictly just the military. And that's because I'm not crazy about the military either. But
what does the civil service option entail? Like just doing things for
like a CNA at a hospital.
Ah, okay.
You know, that type of thing, like a teaching assistant.
Oh, okay.
And it's like cool. AmeriCorps Peace Corps
that's
stuff.
A, yep. That's a civil service option, which I wish, because I did AmeriCorps. It does not pay for nearly enough. But that should be an option for people in diverse roles. And I mean, there are plenty of ways that we could use, you know, jobs like that.
That's an interesting idea. And I don't hate that. I know I was having, I don't remember who this conversation was with, but it was conversations with somebody about some way to encourage more high school students to just take a gap year, whether that's doing some sort of civil service, whether that's going to a trade program, whether that's just going to the job force at all. Even if it's, you know, they go and they wash dishes in a restaurant for a year, whatever that is, they will gain something out of that and they will help have a better understanding of what they want to do. Because how can you really know what you want to do until you've started to do something?
Well, that's you hit the nail on the head, that one. There's a lot of people who start doing our work and they leave because they don't want to work with computers, you know?
Computer's scary. No, but you know what, Eric, now that I think about it, before I graduated high school, I remember, I don't know how much has changed in the last 10 years, but this is what I feel high school should have, you know, because I'm sure a lot of you way older than me have, you know, you had when I was in high school, my last year I took automotive class because I thought, you know, eventually I'm going to have my own car. I'm going to know how to do my own work on it. And I'm glad I took it. Because that year I got my first car, and that knowledge that I was learning helped me fix up my first car and beyond. They had home economics, teaching you how to cook, sew, and all that good stuff, I feel, needs to come back to high schools, because you're going to need that when you're on your own or start a family. And not what those basic things that they think, oh, that's just extracurricular. Why? That's all things that we're going to need in the real world. Put that as a core requirement for your track.
Physics and economics.
Yes. You know, another thing I thought was beneficial back then, I'm sure for all of you that went to school in the 80s, was when they didn't they have like a driving class, like literally that was part of like, that worked with the DMV, like you take the course, and you get your license. I think that needs to come back because
I don't have drivers yet anymore.
Not in the schools anymore, not that I know of.
You had to pay extra. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to do it on your own, which is stupid. It's like, you realize these teenagers that are about to graduate are going into the real world. Some are going to go to college, a trade school, or the workforce. They need to know how to get around and do things like that. That's why I'm like, so the question you were asking earlier, how things have gotten worse from then, I would say that, yes, that has gotten worse.
Well, in middle school, we still had home ec. So, you know, they taught you how to sew, how to, you know, repair a button, and the basics of cooking.
Yeah.
So I would, I would challenge this using the parlance of Brother Hernandez to say how much of that should come from a classroom and how much of that should come from your own home.
That too. Ooh, ooh, me. Tap me. Ooh.
Go for it.
Brother Courtright.
Not everybody has a home that can provide things.
That is also
very fair.
Especially when we're dealing with cost of living that requires two parents working.
Indeed. Yeah.
That is very true as well. So there's a lot of other factors that fall into play. Not many people have parents to come home to because they're both working, or their mom's not in the picture, their dad's not in the picture, discipline is close to non-existent, things like that. So
are you all familiar with the YouTube channel Dad How Do I?
That's all I'm thinking about it.
There's a guy whose father was not in the picture from a very young age. And there were a whole bunch of things that he felt that he could have asked his dad how to do these things, like reversing the polarity on an electrical outlet, changing the oil in your car. He has taken it upon himself to serve as father to the YouTube community. So anybody who wants to post the question, Dad, how do I, you can look up his YouTube channel and get tutorials on all of those things. Let me see if I can find it. I'll put it in the chat.
That's not civil service. I don't know what is.
Yes, I had to learn these things by tearing the car apart with the manual next to me and then hoping I could put it back together again.
But
you actually had the manual?
I don't mean to perpetuate the like millennials don't know how to do anything.
Millennials have YouTube.
I don't touch a car. I would kill something.
Yeah, it's like, okay, my generation. Yeah, are there some people that are lazy, don't want to do shit? They feel they're entitled, they want everything. Sure, but that's with every generation. But like you said, the internet. If you want to figure out how to do something, and if your parents not in the picture or whatever, you got that at your fingertips. You just need to know how to use it.
Yeah, and I recognize that, and I think it's there's a difference between like being like lazy and putting your energy in other things. And I've always been the person who gets super passionate on certain things, and like that's where my energy goes. And then I don't have the energy to do this thing that I don't care about. So it's just a different, I think it's less about like lazy or hardworking, but more about like,
well,
passionate versus
where your focus is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Where your focus is. Yeah.
Eric, I have to say that I have met a significant number of Gen Z, because it's not really a millennial thing. But yeah, they have passion. They're passionate about some things and not passionate about other things. Problem is the things they're passionate about are things that aren't going to help them. That's with fair. Their daily problems. For example, my nephew was really passionate about guitar playing, and after his dad passed away, he bought like 15 guitars. And now he's working a crap job and has no education because he put all his money on guitars and a fancy car.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Priorities too.
So yeah, passion is important, and obviously he's the exception, not the rule, because I have known, I go to school every day with the majority of people who are in. It's a community college, so we're talking like 19 to 23-year-olds for the most part. And they're really mostly a pretty cool bunch. But they definitely have things that they just don't know how to do because they've never had to and there was no reason for them to learn. Right?
Yeah.
Like I had a friend who was 25 and didn't know how to address an envelope because he'd literally never mailed anything to anyone.
So guys, I'm going to interject real quick here. The discussion is still fantastic, but I feel as though we're getting away from the topic at hand. So what I'm going to do is wrap up this portion of the night and stop the recording. Can I just say what a pleasure it's been having you here, Eric, giving the presentation tonight. So thank you so much. This has been fantastic. Plus, I want to make sure that the recording isn't like 2 hours long. So
it's already almost there for the record.
It's pretty close.
No, I appreciate